Rest in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And a good afternoon to you again. I'm Al Cresta here. We've got 2 hours in front of us. Let me tell you what we're doing. Peter and Andrew Infinger are father and son, like many others. But they're different in one special way. They're both priests. They're both called father by congregations. Father Andrew was ordained 2 years ago, and his widowed dad, Father Peter, was ordained this Father's Day. And this vocation... new vocation of fatherhood has brought them together in a special way. We're going to talk with Father Andrew about this unusual circumstance. Also today, we take a look at Brian Carroll, presidential candidate for the American Solidarity Party. He won't win, so why is he running? Also, Dr. Sam Gregg will be with us. We have a problem with industrial policy here in the United States. And so he is joining us to kind of give us a primer on what that debate is about. We're also going to take a look at the bomb in Beirut. I don't want to call it a bombing. That sounds too active. But it was a bomb. And we're going to look back at a previous example, the explosive destruction of Halifax, Nova Scotia, back during World War I. A lot of parallels between what happened then and what happened in Beirut. And we're also going to take time with Father Edward Perrone's attorney. There's some more good news for Father Perrone. So all that's coming up on today's Crest in the Afternoon. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News. For Wednesday, August 12th, it's the Feast of St. Jean Francis de Chantal. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. One of the nation's largest Christian universities is now under new leadership. Liberty University announcing that its board has chosen an interim president days after President and Chancellor Jerry Falwell Jr. was asked to take an indefinite leave of absence. Falwell recently posted what could be considered an inappropriate photo of himself with his wife's assistant during a costume party on a yacht. Schools within the Archdiocese of Louisville will allow in-person classes next week, despite the governor suggesting that districts wait until the end of September to start. Officials say Archbishop Joseph Kurtz spoke with religious leaders across the state before making the call and that things will be reconsidered the week of September 6th, with changes made as needed. Four other dioceses in Kentucky are making that same call. Several Kentucky public districts plan on starting the school year online, including the state's largest district. The Masters Golf Tournament will be missing one thing that makes the major championship what it is. Fans. Sarah Bartlett has details from the announcement.
It means no guests will be allowed at Augusta National Golf Club. Those who were scheduled to go this year will get the same tickets for next year's event. The tournament usually takes place in the spring, but was pushed to the fall this year because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Golfers will compete for the green jacket from November 9th through the 15th. Sarah Bartlett, NBC News Radio.
And Americans won't see a stimulus check in their mailbox anytime soon. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accuses Democrats of making numerous demands that are unrelated to the coronavirus crisis. McConnell called it a liberal wish list and argued that the U.S. economy is at a, quote, tipping point. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria, Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. The good news broke a few weeks ago that a court advisory panel had determined claims that Father Edward Perrone sexually assaulted an altar boy were, quote, false and defamatory. The panel recommended that Macomb Sergeant Detective Nancy LePage pay $125,000 to Father Perrone for damages, which she has now agreed to do. Joining me to bring us up to date on this ongoing story of great interest is Chris Kolomjak, attorney for Father Edward Perrone. Chris, good to have you back. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's talk a little bit about this. We talked back in July, I think second week in July, when the court panel recommended the $125,000 for Father Perrone because he had been defamed by this Macomb sheriff's detective.
Right.
What remained after that? In other words, what had to happen? She had to assent to this payment?
That's correct. Both sides would have had to accept the award and the finding of the case evaluation panel.
Okay.
Otherwise, it would have went directly to trial. And there are, under Michigan law, some penalties for not accepting the award and going to trial anyway. And so that's usually the case when one side accepts and one doesn't. They have to do a percentage better or better than the award. Otherwise, they're responsible for the other side's attorney fees and forcing the trial, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So it does have some teeth to the requirement and to the what we call a case evaluation panel. So in Father Perrone's case, the attorneys and the legal team, with consultation with Father Perrone, agreed to accept the $125,000 award.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this isn't about money. This is about
right.
a reputation and restoring Father Perrone to
absolutely
ministry. That's what
yep.
this has all been about from day one. And so there was really, I mean, we could have chosen to go to a jury, but then if the jury didn't give the same amount, then we'd be responsible for Macomb County's attorney fees. So
right.
it was a risk
right.
that, you know, we didn't want to take. And I think in the case of her, my understanding is that Macomb County is, in fact, confirming that they're going to pay on behalf of the detective.
Right.
So basically, they're accepting responsibility. The county knows what she did was wrong, and they're willing to pay.
Now,
so I don't know if.
Yeah. So I mean, this is.
But
I think for a lot of listeners, we're wondering. Well, certainly this looks like, at least in the eyes of the civil authorities, Father Perrone's been vindicated. How does this?
Absolutely.
So what does that mean for the ecclesiastical authorities and church authorities, for the Archdiocese of Detroit?
Well, we've heard nothing from the Archdiocese of Detroit. I'm sure they're probably trying to sort through this. What does this mean? But I
sure.
can tell you this. She was the sole author of the report
yeah.
that was summarized and went to the review board. She compiled a full report. She signed it. As Nancy LePage for the Archdiocese of Detroit, and that's what went to the review board. She compiled all the data. She put in her report. She put in her thoughts. She put in her everything. So the very report and presentation that the review board relied upon in making their decision and finding a semblance of truth was based on a detective and a report that a independent court panel found was not only defamatory, but serious enough to award six-figure damages, which is very
right.
rare for a defamation case.
Yeah.
Without, you know, he didn't lose his job. There was no economic damages. It's straight reputation.
Yep.
And for Father
yep.
Perrone to get a six-figure award is saying a lot. But nothing from the Archdiocese, really. They really have nothing that they can rely on that they use to remove Father Perone. So I'm hoping that they're doing the paperwork to reinstate him.
Yeah. Has Detective LePage commented on what happened? What did she do wrong, right? I mean, she's now accepted this judgment, so I assume she has rethought this and recognizes that, I don't know, she pulled the trigger too fast or overstated claims or twisted allegations. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what she would have done, but I'd like to know if she'll tell us.
Well, I think we'd all like to know. I'd like to know what Macomb County Sheriff's Department's going to do about this. I mean, right now, this is the big topic in public culture right now, is conduct of the police. And you've got somebody that basically defamed somebody that resulted in their removal and public shaming. I hope something's going to be done about it. But
yeah.
You know, it was an independent investigation for the archdiocese. So I don't know. Why is Macomb County paying? Why are the taxpayers of Macomb County paying for this? I don't know. There's got to be more to this, and I can't imagine what it is. But I'm just hoping and praying that now that we have full vindication and acceptance of this defamation award on the part of Nancy LePage, that the archdiocese immediately returns Father Perone to full ministry.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
At least the public starts writing letters and demanding it. I don't know what else can be done if the archdiocese is just ignoring all of this. But
yeah.
I hope not.
Yeah, I don't understand the mechanics of this. If this, do you know, has this already been put into the pipeline and is in Rome now?
Well, I can say that it has not been given to Rome. Our Canon lawyers have been in Rome. We have a number of Canon lawyers, and one in Rome right now, and another that was just got back, and he said that they have not received the referral from the Archdiocese of Detroit.
Okay.
So there's really nothing for them to act on.
Yeah.
So this is the problem. Can they just sit on this and hope that, you know, the dust settles and everybody forgets about it? I suspect that they could be employing, but
that's not. I mean, that's not going to be effective. This is not. I mean, this is the kind of thing that doesn't get forgotten. At least while a lot of us still have a few more years in our lives, you know.
Well, there has been, you know, and I think, you know, Father Perone is a figure in the Catholic Church that people of Metropolitan Detroit have known for years. And whether you agree or disagree with his methods or how he performs the liturgy or whatever, because I've heard from priests on all sides of the spectrum, and there isn't a single one that I've talked to that has not been terrified by what's happened to Father Perone.
Right.
And many have said, I don't, you know, I'm more on the other side of the fence than Father Perone. But what they've done, what the Archdiocese is doing to him is outrageous, is horrible. And so it's across the board, the outrage. And even with the faithful, I've rarely met someone who wasn't up, that knew all the story about Father Perone, was not outraged and upset by it. So I just hope, you know, in some ways, this acceptance by Nancy LePage of this judgment gives the Archdiocese a way out, in a way.
Yes,
because
I think so.
They can say, look, what were we supposed to do? We relied on this detective who we assumed was doing, you know, a competent job. We didn't know she was defaming Father Perone. What would make us think that? So now that they have something, they don't have to worry about setting a precedent where, you know, every priest that's accused of abuse is going to be subject to all this publicity and litigation. But in this case, this was all for the good, because it brought out all this bad behavior on the part of this detective.
Right.
So I hope the Archdiocese takes this opportunity to say, hey, we're more than happy to return one of our priests to active ministry. This is a good story. This is a happy ending, not a bad end.
Right, right.
But again, what? I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. We're not hearing anything. I've reached out to counsel, who usually responds immediately to me, and I haven't gotten a response back.
Huh.
So I don't know what they're thinking, and they probably don't know either, for that matter.
Can you clarify the relationship between James Smith, the archdiocesan investigator, and Nancy LePage from Macomb County,
I don't know if they have a relationship per se, but I know Jim Smith is really the one that is the official investigator for the archdiocese.
Okay.
I don't know why Nancy LePage was brought in. I have some speculation.
But that, would he have been the one to submit the report to the Archbishop or to Monsignor Bouguerin? And did he draw his material from her interviews?
Well, I'm sure there was a combination of that, but the report that went to the review board, that was drawn up, and then the cover page says, report on allegations against Father Perrone compiled by Nancy LePage for the Archdiocese of Detroit.
Gotcha. Okay.
So there really was no – it was mostly her.
Right.
She did it.
Right.
There's very little of Jim Smith. The only thing I can think of is, I had heard that this accuser wasn't happy with Jim Smith or Jim Smith, asked some questions that bothered him.
Sure.
And then he wasn't willing to cooperate. So then somehow Nancy LePage got put into the mix by Monsignor Bouguerin, who Nancy LePage is a parishioner at St. Joan of Arc.
Yes,
so
that's right.
They knew each other from the parish. So I don't know how that all came to be.
Yeah.
But,
okay.
It is an odd situation, and I just hope they take this opportunity just to say, okay, you can't blame the Archbishop for wanting to take clergy abuse serious, but how was he to know that
he had a bad report.
Sex offender detective was going to defame a priest? I mean, what?
Right.
How could he know that?
Right,
so,
right. All right.
Let's just pray.
Yeah, let's keep praying. Again, hopefully when all this is said and done, we'll see good rather than evil come out of it. But I do
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Chris. Good talking with you again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Chris Kalinjek is attorney for Father Edward Perrone. I'm Al Cresta.
Man failed the first test of freedom. He refused God's plan of love and chose freely to sin and made himself a slave to sin. That first sin gave mankind the gene or inclination to sin, which has given birth to numerous other sins. The Catholic Catechism reminds us that the exercise of freedom does not imply a right to say or do everything. Man is not totally self-sufficient, and his final goal is not his own self-interest and the enjoyment of earthly goals. When man violates the moral law, he becomes his own prisoner, disrupting neighborly fellowships while rebelling against divine truth. For freedom, Galatians tells us, Christ has set us free. He redeemed us from sin, which held man in bondage. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. It took 30 to 60 years after Christ's resurrection for the Gospels to be written. Why weren't they written on the spot? First, the habit of the time was to memorize. Besides, there were no printing presses, scribes were expensive, and illiteracy was high. Second, written records were deemed inferior to an eyewitness who could tell you what happened. Third, the New Testament authors were preoccupied with travel and evangelization, and it's hard to write from a donkey's back. And fourth, the early church expected Christ to return within a few years, so why bother? In the end, these reasons contributed to the broad and quick establishment of the church throughout the known world. And that's evidence for the authenticity of Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, the Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
I would always hear from different people at non-Catholic churches that Catholics were going to hell or that they really didn't know who the Lord was. The Catholic Church is not all what people say it is. I mean, it's completely different. There's so many stereotypes. It's very possible to know the Lord, and it's very possible to have a relationship with God in the Catholic Church. I believe I was born into the Catholic Church, and that's where I belong.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Thank you for being with me. I'm Al Cresta. Beirut is still reeling from last week's explosion. The entire government has resigned in disgrace. There are continued protests there. Lebanon was in terrible economic shape before this disaster. They're now added to their deprivations. You've got 300,000 people, roughly, who are left homeless and displaced. And our friend, Lebanese Maronite priest, Father John Tyers, flying back to Lebanon tomorrow. We'll be talking to him during his stay there. So we'll be getting some, you know, on-the-ground reporting. But I'm glad to say that the great writer, John U. Bacon, has been thinking about this Beirut tragedy and noting parallels that it has with the great Halifax explosion of 1917. And there are lessons and hope that can be taken from the Halifax story and applied to Beirut. John is the author of many books, including The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and heroism, and the memoir, Playing Hurt, My Journey from Despair to Hope, both of which we've featured in previous programs here on Crest in the Afternoon. And, John, it's good to have you back here. Thanks.
Al Cresta, always a pleasure. I listen to you when I'm traveling oftentimes. You've got tremendous reach, and I still hear from your listeners, from my appearance on your show through the Great Halifax Explosion and Playing Hurt with John Saunders, which you cited.
Yeah, that was
so, always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you so much. And this, I really appreciate it, too, that you draw these parallels between Beirut and Halifax. Let's just, for people who don't recall the great Halifax explosion, we're going back to December of 1917. Set it up for us, would you?
Sure. It is near the end of World War I, so like Beirut, which has basically been in a combat zone for years now, including Civil War. World War I is raging all around Halifax, and as a result, once you're in a war zone, basically people cut corners. Yeah. They try to do things faster. They ignore certain protocols and regulations. In this case, they loaded 6 million pounds of high explosives like TNT onto a single ship, which is about 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty. So this is not a good idea to begin with.
Wow.
It stops in Halifax on the way to France to bomb Germans is the idea. It's World War One after all. But it bumps into another ship. The guys on board, the French crew, hops on two rowboats and gets out of there. So now the ghost ship slides down to Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:46 in the morning, and the timing is cruel, as it was in Beirut as well, with people gathering around on their way to school, on their way to work, to watch the ship burn. And then at 9:04, exactly, it blows up, sending a two-mile-high mushroom cloud into the air, one-fifth the power of the atomic bomb, as calculated by J. Robert Oppenheimer, the, of course, architect of the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
The biggest man-made explosion until the atomic bomb. Wipes out half the city, 25,000 are homeless, 2,000 died, and 9,000 are wounded. So it's a horrible situation. But the good news is Boston, which had been more or less an enemy of the United States, at least, had been an enemy of Canada during this time, sends 100 doctors, 300 nurses, $1 million worth of supplies, about $20 million a day, all before Montreal or Toronto got there. And basically saved Halifax, saved 9,000 people, and basically changed our relationship from enemies to allies. So that's what happened there. And amazingly, there are a fair number of parallels 103 years later in Beirut.
The explosion in Halifax was the largest man-made explosion before the atom bomb. Is that right?
That is correct.
Wow. I mean, that's... It's a great story. I'm glad you took it on. Not many people know the story. Of course, a lot more know about it now since you wrote on it. But this cutting of corners, this is something to keep in mind. But it's amazing to me, and I think to most people who have heard the story of Beirut and now Halifax, that otherwise competent people went about their business apparently oblivious to the extraordinary danger to themselves and to everybody around them.
Exactly right. Go
did
ahead.
They I'm just wondering how was this explained after the Halifax explosion?
Well, they made a lot of mistakes, as they did in Beirut as well. It's how you get to such a disaster. One of them was that they did not raise the munitions flag, the red flag, on the Mont Blanc, the ship carrying all these explosives, for fear of getting hit by a German U-boat. But the German U-boats are not in the harbor. They've got those fenced off with two fences underwater. So they should have put the flag up in hindsight, and the crew member said you should, even at the time, to let everyone else know, hey, man, we got munitions, steer clear. Because the ship that ultimately bumped into Mont Blanc was going way too fast, had no idea what they were carrying, and only about five guys in the entire harbor off that ship did know what was in that ship, so otherwise people would not have gathered around afterwards. You would not have had the accident in the first place if you had done that. And second of all, you would not have had 9,000 people gathering around to watch it burn after the fact, so before it blew up. That's one obvious mistake, for example, that they made trying to cut corners and trying to speed things up, which you end up paying a price.
Yeah. When the fire broke out, did anybody warn any of the civilians of potential problems?
Almost none, but one crucially did. As the guys were on the rowboats, the crew from the ship that knew it was about to blow up, they were hightailing it to Dartmouth across the river from Halifax, the unpopulated side, and told almost nobody, but a guy did overhear them saying, "Explosion, explosion," in French, of course, and Al, my French is not very good, but I can pull that one off, and I bet you can too. The other guy in the harbor did. The guy on a nearby boat heard this, and he went directly into the telegraph office of Vincent Coleman, the train dispatcher, right there at the train station right outside Pier 6 where the ship was burning, and said, hey, man, that ship on Pier 6 has got explosives. It's going to explode. You have to evacuate your office. So at first, Vince Coleman says, everyone leave, and he ran also. He started going up the hill of Halifax, and then he stopped when he remembered that the number 10 train from New Brunswick was due in their station in about 5 minutes, and if it landed there, 300 passengers were going to get it.
Wow.
So he thought about it for a second, and then he ran back to the telegraph office, and clicked out by Morse code as fast as he could. Explosives on ship in Pier 6 will explode. Repeat, will explode. And then he added, guess this will be my last message, boys. And it was. About 10 minutes later, it blew up, and Vince Coleman died in that. But that was the only message that got out to Toronto, Montreal, Washington, D.C., Boston, New York, because after that explosion, all the wires were down. So that is the only word that got out, and that is Vince Coleman, by sacrificing his own life, saved thousands of lives in the process.
Wow. What
true
an
hero.
Act of, yeah, heroic action. How long did it take before it sunk in to people in Boston that, in fact, this was going on?
This is one of the incredible parts of the story, Al, and also heroic. They got the wire from Vincent Coleman, so they had news that an explosion was probably about to happen. And they heard later on that something had happened in Halifax, but all the wires are down, so nobody could really report very accurately. So the governor of Massachusetts, Governor McCall, whose lieutenant governor was Calvin Coolidge, of course, later our president, he kept on trying to wire the messages saying, you know, what do you need? How can we help? And after four attempts went unanswered because all their wires are down,
right.
They met at Faneuil Hall in Boston, famous spot, of course, of Sam Adams and many others, John Adams and whatnot, and they gathered together all their leaders. They were prepared for World War I themselves, and now it's a chance to help somebody else. And that's when they voted very quickly to send the 100 doctors, the 300 nurses, the $1 million of supplies, two ships, two trains. They got through the worst blizzard in 10 years, all before anyone else from Montreal, Toronto did. And the people in Halifax, known for their stoicism, when they got word of this, they all started weeping and became American fans, basically, which they were not before this.
Right, right.
So that, as Mr. Rogers from the old show said, whenever disaster happens, look for the good people. And
right.
Boston had thousands of them.
In Beirut, and in Lebanon generally, there's been tremendous civic unrest and economic disaster. Do they have, in your estimation, do they have the civil wherewithal to be able to benefit from the international aid that's coming in? Or will they remain so terribly divided there that rebuilding will be almost impossible?
That is a great question, and it's about to unfold in front of our eyes. Certainly,
yeah.
You're right that the government of Beirut, such as it is, if you can call it one, it was not half as good as the government of Halifax, which had its own problems, I grant you, as we pointed out.
Yeah.
But not nearly as bad as Beirut. You've got civil unrest. You've got civil war, basically, happening there. The relief that you send, that our country, that individuals send into Beirut, is going through Red Cross and other non-government offices, not through the government, because they don't trust them.
Right.
The flip side is the people there have rallied quite nicely, and even Israel has sent aid. Of course, they've been longtime foes of Beirut and vice versa. And that night they flashed the colors of the Lebanon flag on one of their municipal buildings in Tel Aviv, which is a noble act, to say the least. So right now they've got a chance to correct a lot of the problems with Lebanon, and they should take that chance. As Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago once said, never waste a good crisis. They've got
right.
a crisis. If they're smart, they'll use it to reorganize their society.
Yeah. And there's enduring affection between Boston and Halifax to this day, right?
There is. And Al has read the book very carefully. God bless him. yes, to this day, Halifax spends almost $200,000 every year to send the best Christmas tree in the province, a 50-foot spruce every year, to Boston Common to thank Boston for their help 103 years ago. And when I explained to the mayor of Halifax, I said, I hate to tell you, but most folks don't know why they received this from whom or, you know, how it all happened. And her great response was, that is no reason to stop thanking them. So even in the worst of times, the best of spirits can rise.
Very good. John, thanks so much. And let me recommend again this outstanding story, The Great Halifax Explosion by John U. Bacon. It was, I think, our lead interview for that year, 2018 or so.
That's
John,
right.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan. By the way, your listeners are readers. God bless them, they're too.
All right. We'll talk again. The Great Halifax Explosion, John U. Bacon. one of the, it's a story that I never even imagined. It's a great, well-written story, too.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit Angelicum Academy.
This is Father Joseph Essio. I have an important message for all you homeschooling families. You can get an outstanding and fully accredited Catholic college education and save $100,000. To learn how, go to angelicum.net. That's angelicum.net. Earn 75 college credits and an associate's degree in high school for just $3,500 a year, and earn your BA degree just 1 year later at age 19. Check this out at angelicum.net.
The EWTN home video highlight for August is Lourdes with the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. Go on pilgrimage with Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Father John Paul Mary Zeller to the healing waters of Lourdes, where St. Bernadette first encountered Our Lady, and where all are now called to conversion. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
The Call, a call from God. Father Vincent Serpa shares his experience.
It began when I was in second grade. I was preparing for my first Holy Communion, and I went to with my mother and father to see The Bells of St. Mary's, the movie with Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman. He was the singing pastor, and she was the sister principal of the school. And at one point in the movie, the sister was being transferred out of the school, and it was very painful for her because she thought it was because of her disagreements with the pastor, and it was really because she was ill and didn't know it. There's a scene with her kneeling before the tabernacle in the convent chapel. And I had never seen anybody pray before a tabernacle before. I'd seen them pray before statues. But at this particular time in my life, I was learning about the real presence of the Blessed Sacrament in catechism class, and it made a lot of sense to me. The other thing that moved me was that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord. And that was very impressive to me. Shortly thereafter, at the catechism class, the sister that had been teaching the boys was transferred away. And I remember when they announced, my eyes filled with tears because I thought that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord. Again, that just galvanized that whole experience that I had had. And shortly after that, I was at my grandmother's house, and I noticed a picture of St. Martin de Porres, or a statue of him. He was Blessed Martin then, in a Maryknoll magazine. And under it said, Dominican Brother. So I came into the kitchen and I told my mother, I want to be one of those. Years later, I actually did. I became a Dominican lay brother. And then after further discernment, I decided that what the Lord was really calling me to was to be a priest, because I wanted to celebrate Mass. And that's the priest's principal function. It's what makes him a priest, is to celebrate that sacrifice. And that's what I did.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious-life.
Senator Harris, any response?
I think that it's unfortunate that we have someone on the stage who is attempting to be the Democratic nominee for President of the United States, who during the Obama administration spent 4 years full-time on Fox News criticizing President Obama.
That's ridiculous, Senator.
Criticizing people on this stage as affiliated with the Democratic Party. When Donald Trump was elected, not even sworn in, buddied up to Steve Bannon to get a meeting with Donald Trump in the Trump Tower, fails to call a war criminal by what he is as a war criminal, and and then spends full time during the course of this campaign, again, criticizing the Democratic Party.
Bringing the wisdom of Catholic tradition to bear on today's issues. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, and of course, everybody has heard the news now that former Vice President Biden, now the Democratic nominee for president, has chosen his vice presidential candidate, and that will be Kamala Harris. It's not Kamala, right? It's Kama. She makes this point, and it's in a very cute video that she put out trying to get people to speak her name correctly. It's Kama. Think of a comma and then la. Kamala. Kamala Harris tapped yesterday, or earlier today, I guess, late yesterday, as Joe Biden's running mate. In my estimation, I mean, she's not a big tent person. She has seemed to draw the line around who's a faithful Democrat and who's not. And she's drawn those lines. She went after that first clip you heard. She's going after Tulsi Gabbard. She went after Joe Biden in the first debate. In fact, she called him a racist for hanging around with, those who opposed busing. And she is very tight on who fits in her Democratic Party. And that extends to Catholics, too. And we'll go over that a little bit later. But let me go over a few things. Oh, by the way, I should mention one thing that happened today. There's a quote circulating attributed to her, to Kamala Harris, which, in fact, is not her quote. The quote reads like this. "And once Trump's gone and we have regained our rightful place in the White House, look out if you supported him and endorsed his actions, because we'll be coming for you next. You'll feel the vengeance of a nation. No stone will be left unturned as we seek you out in every corner of this great nation, for it is you who have betrayed us." End quote. Now that quote is circulating, attributed to Kamala Harris back in June of 2020, but in fact, it appears to have been an invented quote on a satirical website. Reuters dug into it earlier today and came to that conclusion. Let me turn my attention, though, to Kamala Harris's spiritual life, because, in fact, she does seem to have some kind of, quote, spirituality. She's been attending services at both a Black Baptist church and a Hindu temple. She, in fact, grew up with kind of an interfaith background. They're making much of her as the first black woman and woman of South Asian descent, but she's not African American. She comes really from the Caribbean, Jamaica. That's where her family comes from. So she can't really claim to have the so-called African American experience, because Caribbean blacks have a very different history, very different social history. Her name, in fact, means lotus in Sanskrit, the language of Hinduism. But as an adult, she identifies primarily as a Baptist. She married a Jewish attorney, and so she has respect for the Jewish tradition as well. And I noticed in gathering together information from her speeches that her faith is it's largely ethical. You know, it's all about what we ought to do to others rather than who we are before God and what we owe him. So it's not uncommon, of course, with politicians to reduce religious faith to behavior, what we ought to do. But it's important to remember that when you're looking at, quote, religious faith, you're not just looking at behavior. You're not just looking at rules, what we ought to do. You're also looking at belief. What does this person believe about the ultimate issues in life, the things that matter most? And where do they belong? What's the worshiping community that they're embedded within? And how does that relate to their public affairs? So I think it's clear that she's not afraid to ground her ethics in both
I guess you'd call it Christian and Hindu social doctrine. So during a 2017 speech at a black church in Atlanta, Harris invoked both Hinduism and Christianity, and she was celebrating the fact that she's a daughter of immigrants from both Jamaica and India. When she attended Oakland's 23rd Avenue Church of God as a child, and she said, quote, "We learn about caring for the least of these, and I sang in the choir about how faith combined with determination will always see us through difficult issues." Mentioned that her mom took her and her sister to Hindu temple to see that all faiths teach us to pursue justice. And it's true that the major world religions have some sense of natural law, what we call natural law, some sense that there is a just order to things, there is some ultimate standard of justice. And that same speech, in fact, she tried to portray her approach to her position as prosecutor. She was San Francisco district attorney. Later, she was California's attorney general. And she talked about the biblical concept of redemption. Quote, we will all make mistakes. And for some, that mistake will rise to the level of being a crime. But is it not the sign of a just society that we allow folks a way to earn their way back? That's the concept of redemption. And I guess in the civic sense, that's true. And that is part of, I mean, the whole idea of the penitentiary was meant to be a place to do what? Penance. And to become a penitent. So there's no doubt that the biblical notion of redemption is part of our early expectations of our criminal justice system. When she's in San Francisco, she attends services at Third Baptist Church. Her pastor there has high regard for her, says she's a, quote, spiritual person. Now, she's not spoken about her faith or her convictions as frequently as Biden has. But like I said, she does regularly invoke what we might call biblical values, very big on the parable of the Good Samaritan. And, of course, this is what makes her apparent hostility to Catholicism so incongruous, so contradictory, and maybe downright hypocritical, for heaven's sakes. Bill Donahue and many others have pointed out just in the last 2 days that she seems to have a Catholic problem. You may remember back in September of 2017, Senate Democrat Dianne Feinstein questioning the Catholic legal scholar Amy Coney Barrett. This is became a rather famous moment where she accused Amy Coney Barrett of having the dogma, that is her Catholic upbringing, Catholic teaching, living largely, you know, sounding largely within her. Take a listen to this. You might remember it.
The dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern when you come to big issues that large numbers of people have fought for.
Yesterday to Amy Barrett, you said the dogma lives loudly within her and you're concerned about that. Is that inappropriate?
Is what inappropriate?
To tell a judicial nominee that you're concerned about her dogma.
I'm concerned about the kind of judge she would be.
Now this is the kind of problem, this is the kind of problem that has come up frequently for Democrats. Dick Durbin did roughly the same thing. And in fact, a number of Democrats seem to have trouble with Catholics. Republican Senator John Kennedy, Louisiana, brought this up when he was questioning Bill Barr for the Attorney General post.
You're Roman Catholic, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Do you think that disqualifies you from serving in the United States government?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. Why is that?
Why doesn't it disqualify me?
Mm-hmm. Some of my colleagues think it might.
Because you render under Caesar that which is Caesar's and under God that which is God. And I believe in the separation of church and state. And I, if there was something that was against my conscience, I wouldn't impose it on others. I would resign my office.
Yeah. I think it's called freedom of religion.
Yes.
If I recall.
That's right.
Again, referring to, quote, those on the other side. But it turns out that Kamala apparently is one of those most suspicious of Catholicism. Back when she was questioning Brian Boucher about a federal judgeship, She questioned his suitability for the job because of his membership in the Knights of Columbus. And, here, in fact, here's the quote. "Since 1993, you've been a member of the Knights of Columbus, an all-male society comprised primarily of Catholic men. In 2016, Carl Anderson, leader of the Knights of Columbus, described abortion as, quote, a legal regime that has resulted in more than 40 million deaths, end quote. Mr. Anderson went on to say that, quote, abortion is the killing of the innocent on a massive scale, end quote. And she went on then to say, were you aware that the Knights of Columbus opposed the woman's right to choose when you joined the organization? In 2008, the Knights of Columbus spent $1 million to support Proposition 8, a California ballot initiative that defined marriage as between a man and a woman. Were you aware that the Knights of Columbus opposed marriage equality when you joined the organization? Now, think about that. This is extraordinary suspicion, and it also is extraordinarily ignorant about the teachings of the largest Christian community in the United States. She has apparently no clue as to the acts of charity that the Knights of Columbus are renowned for, or how they handled the first responders after 9/11 and what they set aside for them. They went back and forth on this, Knights of Columbus, because it's a, in my estimation, it's a stand-in for the Catholic Church. That's where the real problem is. Senator Hirano, Democrat from Hawaii, went so far to say that it's an extremist organization. And he asked Boucher if he would end his membership in the Knights. Of course, the Knights of Columbus don't have any policies that are outside of church doctrine. So this, again, goes back to this, the famous Feinstein quote to Amy Coney Barrett. Let me go over this, though. Bill Donahue over at the Catholic League has spent a little bit of time taking a look at this implicit and sometimes explicit anti-Catholicism that's showing up among certain Democrat elites. And this is amazing when you think of what the Catholic Church has meant to the Democratic Party throughout most of the 20th century and into the 21st century. But that is the running mate that Joe Biden chose. And I think it's something to be very concerned about. Pushing the Catholic faith, and really Christian faith in general, more and more to the margins of life, insisting that it be kept a private activity.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11? Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls and rocks, worms, stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year. And CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you. We have more coming up, of course. There's something going on that we've not discussed at any great length before on this program. Sam Gregg has pointed it out. Sam is director of research at the Acton Institute, and he's been a frequent guest over the years on this program. But since 2016, more and more Americans have been calling for local and national governments to expand what they call industrial policy. And what that means is targeting government interventions designed to protect particular industries. Without it, they say, America is not going to be able to maintain its technological edge. We won't be able to reverse the declines in employment that particular regions and specific industries have experienced since the mid-70s. You know, we've seen it now with the rise of China challenging our economic supremacy. And it seems to me that this is one of those areas that those of us who believe we have a commitment to the common good have not really discussed, at least on this program. So we're going to ask Sam to start us thinking about this question of industrial policy and how it contributes or doesn't contribute to the common good. Stay with me. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried at the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
Well, good afternoon. Thanks for coming back, and we've got another hour in front of us here talking about the things that matter most. How about this wonderful story of Peter and Andrew Infinger? They are father-son. They are also both Catholic priests, both fathers. We're going to talk with them later about the unusual circumstances and vocation that called them both into the ministerial priesthood. Also, Brian Carroll is running for president. He's the candidate for the American Solidarity Party. It's a small but growing political party based largely on Catholic social teaching. He won't win, so why is he running? We'll ask him. Also, we're going to be joined by Dr. Samuel Gregg of the Acton Institute. As I mentioned before the top of the hour break, since 2016, more and more Americans have called for local and national governments to create, expand what they call industrial policy. And basically, that's government intervention designed to protect particular industries. Okay, sometimes there's a larger category for this. It's called economic nationalism. And they say if you don't do this, the country won't be able to fill in the blank, maintain its technological edge. It won't be able to reverse declines in employment that particular regions are undergoing. It won't be able to deal with unfair practices
in other countries that are where industries are receiving extraordinary government support. We've seen that in China. What's the trouble with industrial policy? Because my guest, Dr. Sam Gregg, sees lots of problems there. And if we are looking to provide for the common good, and that is, of course, to the sum total of conditions that maximize the human freedom to flourish, then we have to ask, what about this economic consideration? But first, today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, August 12th. It's the Feast of St. Jean Francis de Chantal. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. One person is injured after an Air Force helicopter was shot at during a training operation in Virginia. The UH-1N Huey helicopter was in the middle of a routine training exercise near Joint Base Andrews when someone on the ground opened fire on it. The crew was able to make an emergency landing at a nearby airport and transported the injured member to a hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. The FBI is investigating. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says there's a vast difference in our values between Democrats and Republicans on negotiating another coronavirus relief package.
When commentators say to me, why can't you resolve your differences? Because we're miles apart.
Pelosi says Republicans need to come to the table. The Big 12 Conference says its football teams are still planning to play their regular fall seasons despite the ongoing pandemic. Commissioner Bob Bowlesby says the Big 12 are ensuring their student-athletes a safe place to play football. The season is set to begin for them September 26. Uber will likely shut down its service in California if it's forced to classify its drivers as employees.
We comply by the laws, but if the judge and the court finds that we're not and they don't give us a stay to get to November, then we'll have to essentially shut down Uber until November.
CEO Dara Khosrowshahi told MSNBC he argued that government should create a third way of classifying employees. A California court ruled that Uber and Lyft must classify their drivers as full-time employees, giving them all the benefits required by law. The companies want to keep them classified as independent contractors. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Samuel Gregg, Director of Research at the Acton Institute, the author of several books, including Reason, Faith, and the Struggle for Western Civilization. He writes and speaks extensively on matters of political economy, economic history, ethics and finance, natural law theory. He has a master's in political philosophy from the University of Melbourne and a doctor of philosophy degree in moral philosophy and political economy from the University of Oxford. And recently he had an essay in Public Discourse called The Trouble with Industrial Policy. And I thought this is something we haven't really talked about on this program in a direct way. And I thought it would be good to have Sam back to help us understand it. Sam, good to have you here. Thanks.
Al, it's always good to be with you.
You point out that since 2016, more and more Americans from the political across the political spectrum have called for local and national governments to beef up, expand, deepen industrial policy. What is industrial policy?
Well, you know, it's really a way of talking about economic intervention. It's really a way of explaining why the government should intervene in different sectors of the economy without going full-blown socialist. Mm-hmm. So this, as you said, has become a popular idea on the left, but it's also very in popular on the right as well.
Isn't the idea of economic nationalism part of this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's part of the idea that you need things like the state providing specific subsidies to particular businesses. You need the government to be involved in making public investments in new technology. You need new regulations that seek to nurture new industries or bolster older industries. And all these things fall under the label of what's called industrial policy. And it's obviously a position that is skeptical about the ability of markets to deliver long-term economic prosperity and also to enable people in all parts of the country to prosper in ways that they don't find themselves working in industries that suddenly find themselves no longer competitive because of lack of barriers to trade. So that's what industrial policy is. You find people on the right, like Marco Rubio, for example. He talks about this.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, so does Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
He's effectively arguing in many cases for industrial policy as well. So what's interesting about it, politically speaking, about industrial policy is that it goes across the political spectrum. There are people on the left who like it. There are people on the right who like it. There are also people on the left who don't like it and people on the right who don't like it.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine one of the arguments would be that somehow nations like China unfairly support and strengthen industries which then compete with American industries that are not receiving those kind of subsidies and protections from the U.S. government. And so the claim is it's an unfair playing field. America has to develop industrial policy in order to, you know, make it a more fair competition. Is that the way the argument often goes?
Yes, that's typically the type of underlying assumptions that drive industrial policy. And people also look at things like, say, for example, manufacturing in the United States, and they say, look, manufacturing in America has gone south as a consequence of exposure to trade with, say, Japan, countries in East Asia, China, obviously. And the only way to fix this is for America to embrace the same sorts of policies that are being pursued in some of these other countries. Now, I happen to think that's a mistake, because I think in the end, most of these policies end up running into all sorts of problems, ranging from the inability of the state to know what is likely to be the most productive industries, not just in 10 years' time, but 5 years' time, next week, next year, etc. But also, industrial policies foster a lot of inefficiencies and ineffectiveness in the countries that adopt these types of policies. The classic example is Japan. I'm old enough to remember, Al, that in the late 1980s,
yes,
early 1990s, we were all told Japan was going to take over the world. Japan was, we remember films
Rain, right? Yeah, John Chancellor, the former NBC anchor, had a whole book called The Peril and the Promise or something like that, where he had me scared to death.
For example, like I mentioned Black Rain, films like Die Hard.
Yes.
This whole narrative of Japan was taking over, becoming the world's most powerful economy because
right.
they had consciously pursued industrial policy since the 1950s. But here's the thing. Right at that time when everyone was saying Japan was going to become the new economic superpower, guess what? In the early 1990s, it entered 20 years of economic stagnation. It's called, in Japan, they're called the lost decades. And some would argue Japan has never really recovered from this. And what's most interesting about this is that in 2002, the Japanese finance ministry itself conceded that, quote unquote, the Japanese model, which means industrial policy, was not the source of Japanese competitiveness, but the cause of our failure.
Wow.
So when I'm debating advocates for industrial policy, I always say, here is an example of
right.
where these policies were tried and they failed. So why would we want to do to ourselves what China and Japan have done? In fact, even in China today, we talk about China being this sort of rising economic power, and there is some truth to that. But they've used industrial policy on an extensive scale, and it's already, people who study this very closely will tell you, China is starting to experience some right. of the very same economic problems that Japan did. So
yeah.
while
yeah.
you might feel good about, saying, politicians may feel good about, well, let's do something. Let's have an industrial policy to promote whatever industry it is. That gives you the sense that, okay, we're doing something to fix our problems. But in the end, I think what you do is you encourage ineffectiveness, inefficiency, and by the way, you also encourage a lot of cronyism. Because, you know, money doesn't go to industries. Money goes to specific companies, specific corporations working
yes.
in particular industries. And you know who gets that money? The people yeah. who lobby the hardest. It's not
right.
how good you are.
Right.
It's about how politically connected you are.
Yep, yep. That's very true. The comeback is will be, yes, but the reason we think we have to do something is because we have problems. You know,
yes.
what happened to American steel manufacturing? What, you know, what happened to the American automobile? So lots of these questions come up. So how do you respond to the problem, the fact that there are problems?
Well, there are unquestionably problems. I don't think anyone doubts that. If you just go to some former manufacturing-based cities, you
right.
can see it. The question you have to ask is, what caused these problems?
Mm-hmm.
Was it trade? Well, I'm not inclined to think so. I'm inclined to think that if you want to, for example, look at, say, the automobile industry in Detroit, why did that go down the tubes? I'll tell you why. It went down because of overmighty unions who insisted upon all sorts of things that it eventually started to make it harder and harder for companies to make money. It's also a result of company executives going along with these policies and not challenging them in the first place. It's also a result of pretending that somehow if you raise tariffs, because remember, a lot of these industries are actually already protected, that somehow tariffs was going to fix the problem. All tariffs did was make these American industries even more ineffective and uncompetitive. So we have to ask ourselves, what are the real causes of the problems? We also have to say that if we want to live in a dynamic market economy that produces incredible wealth for 300 million people, you have to say, well, one of the things about living in a dynamic market economy is you need to be flexible, you need to be able to adjust, not just at the level of big corporations, but even at the level of individual workers. And that, you know, that part of the price you pay for prosperity. You can do away with all that innovation, you could do away with all that flexibility, but I guarantee you'll end up like Japan, you'll end up like any number of European countries, you'll end up like where I think China is going to end up. So I think the answer is not industrial policy. The answer is making sure that the economy is flexible enough so that people and businesses and companies can move very quickly and respond to competitive pressures both domestically and from abroad so that they can adjust as painlessly as possible. That, I think, is a much better approach of pretending that somehow we can protect ourselves from people around the world who are just like Americans, wanting to work hard and to make a living.
Are American businesses hampered by overregulation, or is that just limited to certain industries, certain sectors?
Well, my assessment would be that we live in a highly regulated economy. That sounds strange to many people, but maybe the best evidence we have for this is the growth in the sheer number of regulations. So, for example, when you look at, for example, the United States, what you see is that the Federal Code of Regulations, so these are all the regulations issued by the federal government and federal government agencies, that has grown consistently for decades. It's never gone down. Government spending as a percentage of GDP is very high. Government spending on health care and welfare is very high. About the only thing that's gone down is tariffs. So when we talk about America being this sort of dynamic capitalist society, well, it is in some respects, but in other respects, it's highly, highly regulated. And I don't think it's a coincidence that some of the most prosperous and dynamic parts of the economy tend to be the ones that have the least regulation. The most obvious example of that today is the tech industry. That's
right.
relatively unregulated, right? And one of the reasons it's so profitable is because it's not hampered by regulation.
Right, right. Sam, thanks much. We'll have your article here posted for people in the archive so they can follow you on it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Al. Take care.
Dr. Sam Gregg, Director of Research at the Acton Institute. I'm Al Cresta.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong or hurtful, something that needs corrected. Most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
What comes to your mind when you hear the word passion? Passion often signifies intensity of emotions and feelings, frequently in terms of lust. But the Catholic Catechism tells us passions are neither good nor bad in and of themselves. In other words, passions are morally good if they contribute to a good action, and evil if they bring about the opposite result. The most fundamental passion is love, says the Catechism. It is aroused by attraction to the good, the desire to attain the good, and fulfilled by joy and pleasure once the good is possessed. Evil, on the other hand, arouses hatred, aversion, and fear. Passions are the passageway connecting the senses and the mind. Jesus said the source of all passions was the human heart. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. My wife and I have used Seton Home curriculum for our homeschooling. One of the great things about it, you learn about your faith, not just in religion, but history and English and science and reading. Their curriculum uses saints as role models. I don't think they've used me yet. Children are prepared to rationally explain and defend their faith. It permeates the instruction. You want to give your kids not only a top-notch education, but an understanding of their faith as it permeates the subjects that matter in their lives. I don't know if there's too much better than Seton homeschooling. We used it a lot. You are the best teacher for all of that. Let Seton get right beside you and give you the material you need. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Yesterday, Joe Biden announced Senator Kamala Harris as his vice presidential candidate. We know that barring some extraordinary circumstance, that the winning ticket in November will either be Biden-Harris or Trump-Pence. But that's not the sum total of American political activity. There are lots of others running,
including my guest, Brian Carroll, who's the presidential nominee of the American Solidarity Party, a small but growing political party based in large measure on Catholic social teaching. And Brian, it's good to have you with me. Thanks.
Thank you, Al. It's great to be here.
Well, let's, let me ask you, what was the origin? What was the cause? Why did the American Solidarity Party come into existence?
Well, I wasn't there at the beginning. In 2011, there were a group of people that started talking about asking the question why the United States did not have a party in the tradition of what in Europe is the Christian Democratic Party, also in Latin America. Mm-hmm. And they decided to start one. And I joined in 2016, so I missed all that early stuff.
Yeah.
But we grew quite a bit when people took a look at the choices that were offered by the major parties in 2016, and a lot of people said, there's got to be something else. And I was one of them.
Yeah.
And so I said, let's find something else. And within a couple of weeks, I found the American Solidarity Party.
A few months ago, the bioethicist Charles Kamesey resigned from Democrats for Life and decided mm-hmm. that pro-life people really didn't have a place in the Democratic Party anymore. And he became, as I understand it, the news story said that he joined the American Solidarity Party. Is that right?
Yes, and I don't personally know Charlie. We're friends on Facebook, but
yeah.
That's, I just only know what he's written.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, so there are people who are dissatisfied with the Democrats on one hand, Republicans on the other. They don't line up with their preferred political platform. And so they look around. Who does the American Solidarity Party appeal to? What kind of people are interested in it?
I think we're going to draw from three groups. One will be Democrats who have always been pro-life and thought there was a place for Democrats or pro-life people in the Democratic Party. And this year they have realized that they are being purged,
right?
Quite intentionally purged. And so that will be one of our groups. Another group will be Republicans who were Republicans because of being pro-life. I was in that situation for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to question just how much the party was dedicated to that idea and how much we were being used by more economic interests.
Sure.
Who needed our votes. And I began to have doubts when I heard George Bush, second person Bush, say that we did not need a personhood amendment.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, wait a minute. That's why I've been voting Republican all these years to get that.
Right.
And then there were some other things along the way that just made me question how dedicated the Republicans were to that. And,
okay.
Of course, many Republicans are irritated that the president is separating families at the border and that he's cutting back in medical care and other safety net things, nutrition, mm-hmm. for kids. And so there's a lot of dissatisfaction on those fronts within the Republican Party. And then the third group are the independents, the people who've just given up completely voting, and they're just so fed up with the system, and we hope to pull some of them back.
Well, let's go over some of the features, the platform planks of the American Solidarity Party. Where do you like to begin? You've already mentioned the pro-life issue, so I assume that's important to the party.
Mm-hmm.
And where else do you go?
Well, a lot of them are interrelated. You know, you can't really separate out life issues from justice issues. If you value everybody as a child of God,
uh-huh.
then you have to also think of terms in justice. And justice, of course, there's racial justice, there's economic justice, there's environmental justice. So that's a whole category there. And that, of course, gets us into environment. If we no longer have a planet that we can live on, that is a life issue. Mm-hmm. And so all of the environmental things, you know, we have lots of people in our country drinking really foul water, breathing really foul air. In some of our economically depressed areas, life expectancy is 12 years, 15 years shorter than in the more economically successful areas. And so that gets environment into justice, into life. And then the last area that's really important to life, of course, is war. And when we put so much of our energy, our economy, into producing materials of war, that means it's not going into social safety net kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And we are treating other countries horribly. You know, the crisis in Yemen is an example where we've sold so many weapons to the Saudis, and it's just a horrible humanitarian disaster for the people who were there. So they're all interrelated.
Do you stand on questions of religious liberty?
I am strongly in favor of religious liberty and shook that it's being challenged. Right now there are so many different fronts. The recent Supreme Court case, or I guess they decided not to handle it, but the case from Nevada, a church was saying that the COVID was stacked, the efforts, you know, limitations on people and things were unequally applied, so that churches were being discriminated against where casinos could stay open,
right,
with much larger crowds. You know, those kinds of arguments are pretty strong.
Yes.
I'm all in favor of the church living by the standards that others have to live by. But it seems like many states have gone out of their way to target religious organizations with the COVID-19 restrictions. And, of course, that's just one example. Another example, of course, would be in the prosecution of David Daladin and Sandra Merritt,
right.
On the Planned Parenthood videos.
Yes.
That's not just religious rights, but First Amendment rights,
right,
of newspaper media.
Yeah.
You know, they should be protected. If you go all the way back to the John Peter Zenger case, the conclusion was, it's not libelous or slanderous if it's true.
Right.
And that's what we've got going here.
But I do think, in fact, that Kamala Harris is still named in a lawsuit that David is litigating.
I just saw that today, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about criminal justice reform, because that's one of the areas in which there's actually more common ground between Republicans and Democrats than one might think. There's a widespread mm-hmm. dissatisfaction with our criminal justice system. And, of course, as you point out in your platform, criminality is complex, and it is the result of a culture that does not respect life. And when you've got the breakdown of traditional social institutions, you're going to have crime. You're going to have problems. You're going to have social alienation. You're going to have recidivism. It's one thing to say we have problems, another thing to propose solutions. So what would you take on in the American Solidarity Party when it comes to criminal justice reform?
The very first thing I would do is get rid of private for-profit prisons. Nobody should be making a profit over somebody else's misery, and the temptation is too strong if the owner of the prison is making extra dollars by filling up beds. You know, he's going to find ways to keep people in prison longer for his economic benefit, not for the corrections purposes. Mm-hmm. So that's the first place.
Okay.
Then we need to do more kinds of things where we have people, and we'll have to beef up our probation departments and those kinds of things. But nonviolent prisoners should be out where they can stay attached to their families. I was a school teacher for 40 years, and I would see kids who had been separated from one parent or the other for any number of years because the parent was in prison. Well, that's just passing it on to the next generation. You've got a generation that's coming up, and they're confused. They don't have any kind of good guidance. We could approach that with more family services, more kinds of training, and the people who are truly violent need to be locked up.
Okay.
But those who can be integrated into the economy, given jobs, pay restitution, those kinds of things, we put more people in prison than any other country in the world. And obviously we're doing something wrong there. We've got to reverse those trends.
I wanted to take today just to get a brief profile of what some of the things you stand for. But let me ask you the question everybody's got to be thinking, and that is, why are you running? You're not going to win.
Well, yeah, the chances are poor. Any given day, either baseball team can win, no matter who's playing out there. But chances are poor. I understand that.
Right.
And we're building a party. We ran a candidate in 2012 and a little bit stronger candidate in 2016.
Okay.
And we expect to do quite a bit better than that this year. And we'll come back with another candidate in 2024.
Very good.
And,
Brian, we'll talk again. We'll talk again. We're kind of short of time, but... there are lots of other questions I'd have for you, but we don't have time for them today. We'll talk soon. Thanks.
Yes, very good.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit Angelicum Academy.
This is Father Joseph Essio with a very important message to Catholic families. If you've been told that Catholic education is non-essential or that homeschooling is harmful, don't believe it. Catholic education is essential for forming solid citizens of both the earthly and the heavenly kingdoms. And parents are the first and primary educators given that role by God. If your schools and jobs are shut down as being allegedly non-essential, here's how to turn that to your family's advantage. Your high school students can get an outstanding Catholic education online with 75 college credits and a fully accredited associate's degree by 12th grade, saving your family over $100,000 in college costs. To learn how, go to angelicum.net. For just $3,500 a year, they can earn 75 college credits in high school, then earn their accredited BA degree just 1 year later at age 19. Check this out at angelicum.net.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
You as a parent apply Galatians 5. Is watch your kids as they move into the religious space, if you want to put it that way. I, made noises about the priesthood on and off when I was a little kid. My parents were never oppressive about it. They never pressed me in that direction. But they would quietly indicate an openness to that, or like, that's a good thing. I remember I still have it upstairs, a Bible that my parents got me for Christmas in 1969. I'm a little kid. and it's, you know, from mom and dad to Bob, Christmas 1969. They knew, they sensed I was kind of interested in religious things. So I would say that, don't be pushy, of course, but don't go the other direction. That's, my generation got too much of that, was, back off, who am I to tell you what to do? You make your up your mind. No, I think gently, quietly, affirming that, yeah, that's a good thing you're thinking about, and you should be open to that.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
What is catechesis, and why do we care? The job of catechesis is to reveal all the joy as well as the demands of the way of Christ, says the Catholic Catechism. The way of Christ is summed up in the catechesis of the Beatitudes. Jesus gave us the 8 Beatitudes in his Sermon on the Mount. The Catholic Catechism tells us this teaching is the only path that leads to the eternal beatitude, happiness, for which the human heart longs. The catechesis of sin and forgiveness challenges us. Unless man acknowledges that he is a sinner, states the catechism, he cannot know the truth about himself, which is a condition for acting justly, and without the offer of forgiveness, man could not bear the truth. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Peter and Andrew Infanger share a father-son relationship. They're father and son. But they are also father and father, both ordained to the Catholic priesthood. Father Andrew 2 years ago. Father Peter was ordained this last Father's Day. And Father Andrew now joins me. He serves the Wisconsin parishes of St. Robert in Shorewood and Holy Family in Whitefish Bay. And will begin serving at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Catholic Newman Center later this month. Well, Father Andrew, good to make your acquaintance. Thanks.
Hello, hello. Good to be here.
This is a wonderful story. It's a fascinating story, and I'm impressed with it simply on the grounds that you and your father must have had a darn good relationship growing up. Is that true?
You'd think so. It was good. We were always close, but there was definitely a time, of a number of years when I was probably starting in middle school through the end of high school where I, particularly on my end, I really gave him a hard time and really rang him through the ringer. So, if he's on his way to sanctity, I suppose he could blame me for testing his mettle a little bit.
Very good. You're 32, I think, right now. Is that right?
32 years old? Well, I just turned 33, and I've gotten a lot of jokes because of that. But yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me, when did you begin to consider the idea of priesthood? When did you have a sense of calling, or was this one of those things in your family where it was expected that one of the boys would become Catholic? Or become a priest, excuse me.
Yeah, no. It was definitely not an expectation of me and my brother. It's just me and my brother that one of us would become a priest.
Yeah.
And, I had good experiences with priests growing up. I always had good priests at my parishes. And, I went to church, went on youth retreats and things like that. I had my own little challenging time in high school, and probably a lot of folks do, a little rebellious stage.
Yep.
And it wasn't really until... I had a couple of long-term relationships, and I think I learned a lot about myself, good and bad through that. And it wasn't really till I was single, and I spent a year volunteering. I lived with a group of priests, and that I think my heart started to open to the idea of it. Because I think, not to go on, for too long about why I didn't like the idea of becoming a priest as a young man, I suppose I just thought I was... I always was dating someone, and so I just never thought. I figured if you dated, you couldn't become a priest.
Right.
But it wasn't until I started living with them and sort of seeing priests in their daily life that I think the idea started to sort of, soften my heart. And then after that year of volunteer, I worked as a youth minister for a year, and it was really during that time that I really had a sense of a call that I had never really had before. So a couple of years after college.
And while you were discerning, what was going on with your father?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know how much folks maybe who've read a little article or seen the news story, but my mom died rather suddenly from breast cancer, but it was sort of undiagnosed until very late stage. So not expected, cancer never is, but didn't have like a long journey of sickness, at least that we knew about.
I see.
And so it kind of just got thrown onto my dad's life too. And I was in my first year of seminary, and my dad is now living in a new city. His job was relocated by himself. He had sold his house. And I mean, I remember even driving down from Milwaukee to the Chicago area and, like, taking him to the grocery store and, you know, saying, hey, here's how to, like, cook broccoli. And, you know, you need to buy towels and, like, air freshener and soap and, yeah, you know, things that he had never really done before.
Sure.
And, but in the midst of all that, he had this call to go to the seminary, which at first I kind of tried to dissuade him from a little bit. Although he says I inspired it, I thought I was trying to discourage it. So
yeah,
it depends
yeah.
what side of the story. Just thinking, you know, he's, you know, in his late 50s, and that's not your typical time to go to the
right.
seminary, and I don't know if they would have let him in. And also, it's just my dad. It's sort of, for a young man, it's sort of kind of weird to be kind of blunt about it, to think of your dad as a priest. You know, most people's parents aren't priests, Catholic
right,
priests.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, and then, you know, he was saying, well, I could come up to Milwaukee maybe to go to the seminary. And I was in my first year, and for guys who are in the seminary or are priests, they know that usually those first couple of years are still a time of discernment. So I was like, Dad, I think I'm going to be a priest, but I'm in my first year, and maybe I don't. Maybe I leave after 2 years. And
sure.
So don't come here for me. Go where you think that God is calling you, not just because I'm nearby. And so he ended up staying down where he's living. My brother lives in near Chicago as well, so it just made more sense. His grandkids near there, and
yeah.
you can see them a lot more. And, yeah.
Yeah, well, you've got seminary options in the greater Chicago area for certain. That's true, yeah. So he was ordained just this last Father's Day, is that right?
Yep, yeah, I think it was on, because Father's Day was on Sunday, right? So, yeah, he was ordained on Saturday.
He was on, okay.
And then that first Mass is on Sunday.
So were you able to attend his ordination?
I was. I attended the ordination. I was able to vest him. You know, I don't know if it was to the chagrin of anyone or not, but I lowered my mask to vest him. So I don't know if
that's
I
right.
my dad, I can.
I wasn't thinking
I can do
of that.
That. And I,
yeah.
And we weren't supposed to hug, but I hugged him anyways when I vested him because I figured, you know, they can send me to prison for hugging my dad on his ordination day if they want. But yeah, I'm kidding. But you know, but I did
know.
Do that, and I thought about it. Yeah, and I preached his first Mass on Father's Day, which was its own. Task, I suppose, or honor.
Yeah. You think he said in this article that you're a good homilist. Did he take notes on you?
I told him he is known for being a note taker, like a profusive note taker, and sometimes we'll like talk on the phone. He's like, "Wait, say that again. I want to write that down." And I always get irritated. I'm like, "Dad, stop writing stuff down." So I joked before the first Mass. I'm like, "Dad, you are not allowed to take notes during your first Mass. You just have to." Just sit there and experience it and not necessarily worry about, you know,
yeah.
what's going to come of it. So I know we had the conversation and said, you can't take notes. He laughed.
Was your family a fairly intense Catholic family as you were growing up?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I always have to speak well of my mom. I pray she's looking down from heaven now, but she wasn't the most religious person. She had a deep
yeah.
faith in her own, but she didn't always come to church with us.
Yeah.
My dad tried to introduce something like a family rosary, but I remember specifically my brother and I, my mother, actively resisted him, so that fell, you know, that
yeah.
fell away pretty quickly. But, you know, he would take us to church, and I remember walking to church with my dad, being in, you know, in middle school and in high school on a kind of a Sunday night where church was close enough we could walk. And so he did his part. I remember, though, seeing him, you know, every morning, he would get up very early for work, and the times that I would be up before he had left, which was rare, I'd see him reading the catechism and mm-hmm. scripture every morning. You know, his Bible is just sort of filled with underlines, and he's like, you know, I laugh. It's like, if you underline everything, there's no purpose in underlining stuff. That's just how he was, you know.
Right, right.
But we were not intense. I mean, I didn't, and he might even admit some fault, I suppose. Like, I didn't really know, like, things that I learned in the seminary, things that I now know are traditional Catholic things, like Saint feast days, or really even, you know, following different sort of days of fasting necessarily. And, I just didn't know about it. I mean, he tried his best, and you know, he's not a perfect Catholic, I suppose. We're all practicing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think, like him, like a lot of parents, you figure it out as you go along, and sometimes it's hard
right.
to go back in time and do that, yeah.
Well, I think that's encouraging to a lot of parents who think that if they aren't, you know, having a time of intense rosary every night, if not observing all the feast days and the fast, that somehow they're second class Catholics. I think
that just,
you know,
the witness of, as I was telling some folks earlier, I was talking, and I think for me, one of the big witnesses that he left was just his ability to love with a sense of sacrifice.
Yeah.
I think that if I want to say what inspired my priesthood from my father, you know, I'd say that's probably up there, you know, among the top things, to see someone love sacrificially.
Yeah, yeah. You've been a priest for 2 years, so you're still fairly young at it. Has it met your expectations? Have you been surprised? Of course, we've had this COVID-19 thing over the last 6 months, so that's got to throw some monkey wrench into the machine. How's it been for you?
Yeah, well, like you say, there's been two different eras of my priesthood now in my
yeah.
short time, pre-COVID and post-COVID. But, you know, I don't know if I had such a huge expectation. I feel like I have had a pretty realistic view of the world. I can be a little cynical sometimes, and so
mm-hmm.
when things turn out well, I'm sometimes a little more excited because I don't always expect them to.
Yeah.
I call myself a realist, but some people might say I'm a little cynical that way. So I would say there have been times as a priest where I had a moment, whether I heard a confession or had a moment with a family or you know, visiting a prison or in the nursing home, where you say, okay, if I were to get struck by lightning today, it was worth it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I get one of these moments in once in a blue moon, then it's doable.
Yeah.
And then there are other moments where you have a particular sort of, you know, loneliness or a particular sorrow, whether it's because of your own inability to do something or to change someone, or, you know, you see families and their joy and you realize that you won't have that. But there's a kind of a sorrow that you can carry along. But I've talked to enough married couples now to realize, and people of all stripes and color, that comes with life too.
Yeah.
So that doesn't weigh on me. It's there. And the Lord is there too. And I think the key is to find God through it as opposed to around it or something. But then I remember vividly that I just knew that this particular Sunday was going to be the last Sunday before we were going to statewide lockdown or whatever in Wisconsin. And I really preached as though it was the last Mass I'd ever preached in my life. And I'm not a particularly emotional guy, but I definitely felt the tears kind of welling up.
Yeah.
And I remember the first reading was, I can't remember the exact reading. I should look this up. But it was about, or it was the psalm maybe, about how the temple was destroyed and there was no prophet or sacrifice offered in the temple. And it's just everything was kind of perfect. That was a real sad day, knowing that things would be different after this.
Yeah.
I mean, I really felt
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't see that coming when I was ordained.
No, who would have, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Who was more surprised? Was your dad surprised when you were ordained, or were you surprised when he was ordained?
I think that if anyone knew my dad, if they could have, you know, they wouldn't be surprised that someday he would give his life in religious service. If they had known my dad for the last 25 years or so, no one would be shocked by my dad dedicating his life to religion.
Okay.
If people knew me when I was 16, I think they would have been shocked that I would have become a priest.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I remember I had a guitar teacher from eighth grade to like sophomore year of high school. He was a Baptist, and he had tragically has since died of what seems to be an apparent suicide. So he had his own tragic ending. He seemed to have and I didn't think about this. He like had like prophesied my ordination. I saw him when I was 21. My parish youth minister took me to a bar for my birthday with a bunch of volunteers, and he was sitting at the bar by himself. And I hadn't seen him in 7 years, and he just said, "Someday you will confess the sacrament."
Wow.
And it was like, I'm 21, not thinking about the priesthood. I'm there to, have some drinks on my birthday and with some friends in a wholesome way. And I didn't think twice of it. I just thought, that's a little odd, but hello. But in hindsight, I'm like, wow, I wonder if it's like a sort of a strange manifestation of God's sort of prophecy. I don't know. So some people saw it. Yeah. I didn't see it.
Well, Father, thank you so much. We're out of time, but I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. It's a marvelous story and an encouragement to all of us. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, "Appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world. The strong nuclear force, the strongest physical force in the universe, holds atoms together. If the strong nuclear force were just 10% weaker, atoms would fly apart and Earth would disintegrate. And if the strong nuclear force were just 4% stronger, the hydrocarbon atoms in your body would fuse into heavy metals. Most remarkable, this strong nuclear force is only active within a few quadrillionths of a meter around each atom. That life in the universe are so finely tuned is something to appreciate. Today, tell someone how you appreciate the wonderful way creation is designed. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Well, thank you very much for being with me today, and I want to remind you, of course, that you can follow up on any of our conversations by going to AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the online bookstore there. You'll be able to find the Great Halifax Explosion that we discussed a little bit earlier. Also, Sam Gregg's books will be there as well. And for the articles that we use in preparation of the interviews, go to the Cresta Guest Archives at AveMariaRadio.net.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.